Into the Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Monday, October 7th, 2013. This is podcast number 352, and my name is Ben Stone. As you've been hearing me talk about, Bitcoin Not Bombs is running a program called Hoodie the Homeless, an organization called Mass Appeal, Inc. That's Mass Appeal, I-N-K, Mass Appeal, Inc., has offered a great deal on 324 discount orange hoodies. And the folks at Bitcoin Not Bombs plan to take these hoodies, have them printed up with Bitcoin Not Bombs logo on them and Bitcoin information, and distribute them to the homeless in San Francisco before the winter hits this year. And that's the whole purpose of this. So they need 47 Bitcoin to pull this off. That's the amount of Bitcoin that Bitcoin Not Bombs needs in order to buy the 324 hoodies, have them printed, and distribute them. Now, so I've been doing these commercials for Bitcoin Not Bombs, encouraging people to get over to BitcoinNotBombs.com, and there's a variety of different ways you can help. You can just donate directly to Bitcoin Not Bombs. You can buy a T-shirt, and the price of the T-shirt will cover you getting a T-shirt and a hoodie going to the homeless. Or you can, I think it might be too late to join the Bitcoin Starter campaign. It's probably shutting down within a day or two of my recording this on Monday the 7th. But either way, even if it's past the time frame that the Bitcoin Starter campaign is going, even if it's past that, you can still go to Bitcoin Not Bombs and donate and help to bring hoodies to the homeless in San Francisco. And it's accomplishing several things. I mean, first off, it's like having 324 billboards walking around advertising Bitcoin Not Bombs. It's a good way to get to engage in charity and do something nice for somebody. I mean, there's all kinds of positive aspects of this. And another thing, and I think I've mentioned this on the podcast, you know, Davi over there at Bitcoin Not Bombs tells a story about a guy in San Francisco who was down on his luck. He was homeless. He was out of a job. He was really struggling. And he was digging through a dumpster one day, and he finds this shoeshine box that someone had thrown out with different shoeshine equipment in it. And so he takes it, and he goes down to one of the local thrift store type places, and he buys himself some clothes, and, you know, that make him look halfway decent. And he goes and he starts shining shoes, and he ends up making a pretty good amount of money doing this. Well, and I'm talking like several thousand dollars, like $5,000 or $7,000, something like this, that he ends up getting it in a bank and actually having the money. And so he's moving towards the possibility of actually renting a place and not being homeless anymore and really starting a business and being able to live. And one of the local media catches on to his story, and they publicize what he's doing in this rags to riches, not really riches, but this, you know, up by your bootstraps type story. And the city finds out about it, and they swarm in, and they take his money. Well, they couldn't have done that if he had exchanged his money into Bitcoin. They wouldn't have been able to touch it. You think of the story of the Silk Road right now, you know, the so-called Dread Pirate Roberts, the FBI, if we believe the story, after extensive investigation, which I don't buy, they have scooped up the guy that they believe to be Dread Pirate Roberts. They've arrested him, but they can't get to his Bitcoin. Now they got something like 70,000 Bitcoin or something like that, 65,000 Bitcoin or something, or maybe it's 25,000, I can't remember. But they grabbed some that was that was available to them in Silk Road exchanges. They grabbed that, but they can't get his they can't get the Dread Pirate Roberts encryption keys cracked, so they can't get to his Bitcoin, and that could be millions and millions. Maybe they're speculating like maybe 80 million Bitcoin or something like that. Anyway, so my point in that is that if this guy in San Francisco, this homeless man, had exchanged his Federal Reserve dollars for Bitcoin, the city wouldn't have been able to touch him. They couldn't prove he had a nickel. It's all encrypted, and he couldn't, and they couldn't do anything about it. And a lot of these people, a lot of the homeless people have a cell phone. They just don't have a home. I mean, after all, a cell phone's pretty cheap compared to a home. And if you've got a modern cell phone, you can use Bitcoin. So, you know, so this is an aspect where, for people on the streets like that, this could really turn into something for them. So anyway, think about getting over to BitcoinNotBombs.com and helping out if you can. And speaking of Bitcoin, I wanted to thank again the folks who donated Bitcoins, to BadQuaker.com and for the BadQuaker 2014 campaign. And we've gotten more, in October already, and I appreciate whoever that was. Again, it's all anonymous, but whoever that was, I appreciate the donations. And, you know, hopefully, and we've made some changes. I should probably mention this. We're no longer taking paid advertisements. So you're going to hear advertisements on badquaker.com still, but they're not paid advertisements. We're advertising for companies and for people and for causes that we believe in, but it's not paid advertisements. So, for example, you know, you've heard me endorse a Magi Metals before, and I still do, and we'll probably still run their commercials from, you know, from time to time, because it's a good company and it's a good way to preserve wealth out of the hands of the Federal Reserve. So you'll probably hear commercials for that, but we're not charging, or we're not charging anybody for advertising time. We're giving that to them for free. And, for organizations that we believe in. So it's the same thing with Sons of Liberty. We're going to give advertising to Sons of Liberty. We're going to give advertising to Bitcoin Not Bombs. We're going to give advertising to the Freedom Fiends. We're going to give advertising where we believe that it will do people good. So that's our new policy. All right. Well, now 8 minutes into the podcast here, and I haven't even talked about what I'm going to be talking about today. And that's kind of a precursor to what today's podcast is going to be like. I have some of the most disjointed notes that I have ever put together for a podcast. I have no idea if I'm going to be able to wrap it up and make it, you know, sound sane or sound like it has some kind of purpose. I'm not sure if my notes are going to carry through for 25 minutes or, you know, if I'm going to have to cut them off at an hour and 10 minutes or something because it just keeps going. I'm not sure. I have no idea. As I begin this podcast, I have no idea how long it's going to go or if I'll be able to wrap it around and make any sense out of it. Today's podcast, I have tentatively named it A Weekend in America or Mainstream Media Hype, Lies, and Distractions. And I'm not sure exactly how I'll end up naming it, but that's my working title for it. But before I get into that, and since I've already been talking about San Francisco and Davi's project out there of getting hoodies to the homeless, I want to read a story coming out of San Francisco. This is on the AP Wire. And this is just a brief little thing. It says, at least for one afternoon, the chess players were back at their usual spot where they've occupied for years along downtown San Francisco's busy Market Street. But instead of hustling a dollar here and a dollar there, with deft openings and clever traps, the mostly homeless players and their supporters were playing Sunday in defiance of a recent police crackdown and ban on the public chess games. And they were backed by a brass band and several homeless advocates who helped organize the three-hour chess inn under bright blue skies on a hot San Francisco afternoon. Earlier this month, police confiscated chess gear, tables, and chairs at the site. So here's kind of the, and this story has absolutely nothing to do with the point of today's podcast, but I wanted to throw it in as sort of a positive thing to begin with, because I'm going to be throwing a lot of negative stuff out. Here we have a situation in San Francisco where the nannies have decided that they can't have these wild gangs of chess players sitting around in the parks. You know, these old men sitting around in the parks playing chess. We just can't have these wild hoodlum gangs of chess players out there and enjoying the sun and enjoying life and playing chess. And who knows, something really, really bizarre evil might happen. Like they might, you know, they might gamble on one of the games or something like that. Oh, we can't have that. We can't possibly allow these old men to enjoy themselves. We have to go in and knock over their tables and take their stuff, because that's what cops do, right? That's what nannies in government do, right? And in defiance of that, these old people just went out there and said, you know what? We're going to play chess. We're going to do it. And I hope they continue doing it. And I hope they bring enough attention to themselves that the nannies in the government in San Francisco, California back off. And I hope, I deeply hope that the police thugs who come up there and take their stuff feel guilty and think about it at night and think about it in the morning when they look in the mirror and realize that they are the problem. They are the thugs. They are committing evil. When they follow their orders, when they go down there to those parks in San Francisco, and when they take those old people's chess sets and their equipment, they are the evil ones. They are the lawbreakers. Those guys in uniform, those cops, those pigs, they are the lawbreakers. And those gentlemen sitting there playing chess, those are good people. And the cops are bad. But in the long run, and this is the good part, in the long run, the nannies will lose. The nannies will fall. The nannies will fail. The chess games will continue. Even if you don't see them in the park, the chess games will continue. Because prohibition does not work. The nannies never win in the long run. Evil loses. Cops, you're losing. You're gonna lose. Now, back to today's topic, and to get into something a little less pleasant. I think that's pleasant. I think that's wonderful that those old guys will go down there and just play chess anyway. Like, arrest me. What are you going to charge me with? Aggravated chess playing? So, weekend in America, mainstream media hype, lies, and distractions. It's been a really weird week. You know, over the weekend, over the last weekend, I normally don't do these, you know, news and review or tyranny of the day type, podcasts, but it's been such a weird weekend and a weird week, last week that I just think I need to point out how the mainstream media operates, how they just take lie after lie after lie and compound it upon itself. And they control the narrative and they get the public to look in the way that they want you to look and not look in the direction that they don't want you to look. So, you know, before I get into that, I want to lay down some fundamentals here. We pretty much, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably understand that war is the health of the state. And that's a very old saying, but it's true. War is the health of the state. The state depends on war. The state has gone through four metamorphoses, and it's going to experience one more metamorphosis. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, in the beginning, you know, the state was essentially, really we're talking early government here. They were essentially bands of roaming nomads or bands of roaming thieves that would strike, mostly people who were settled, farmers, so forth like this, who were settled in one spot. And these roaming thieves would strike and rob all that they could, and then they'd leave. Or they would find, you know, they would find hunter-gatherers moving from one place to another, and they would strike them, on the road, so to speak, and take as much as they could, and then they would leave. But there was a metamorphosis that took place about 9,000 years ago where, there were permanent settlements had developed, and farming had changed. And so, so a single farm could now overproduce. It could produce far more than what the farmers living on that farm, actually needed. So there was an abundance, of produce being made. And at that moment, there was a metamorphosis that took place. And when a band of robbers figured out that they could essentially build a fortification and then ride out from that fortification and steal from their neighbors directly around them and then come back to that fortification and protect themselves from those neighbors. And in exchange for that, they kind of had this, well, of course, and I've gone into this before, how the myth of, the religious myth came into it to justify them. And there was a whole thing. I'm not going to go into the whole thing today, but that metamorphosis took place where government went from being roaming bands of thieves to a stationary band of thieves that rode out from one location and used legitimacy. The state literally was born at that. The myth of the state was born. The idea that that it can be legitimate for the government to steal like that. That was the birth of the state, and that was the birth of the imaginary situation where we believe that those robberies are justified. Okay, so that was the first metamorphosis of the state. And then we see the second metamorphosis. And this is essentially, this is the birth of the city state. The government couldn't reach out any further than about a day's ride around the city state. But the state existed in the sense that people believed that it was legitimate. So the first manifestation of the state, or that first metamorphosis that created that manifestation of the state, was the city state. Eventually, the city state became big enough and powerful enough, and there became unions between city states, and eventually there was a new metamorphosis, and it became the ancient empire. And so massed armies, now you have a much larger area that you can tax, a much larger area that you can force young men to join the military, or to be enslaved by the military, I should say. And so the ancient empire was born. And so that's the second metamorphosis of the state, was into the ancient empire. And then the third metamorphosis of the state was into the modern, not modern as in today, but modern as in a couple thousand years ago, monarchy, where you have a hereditary monarchy, what we saw in Japan, what we saw in China up until the early 1900s, what we saw throughout Europe. The monarchy, and it might be parliamentary or it might not, but the monarchy with based on a family heritage. Okay, and then around 1600, actually, and this was kind of a slow transition, it didn't fully take place until 1900, but between 1600 and 1900, and I might say, none of these changes took place rapidly. The state evolved very slowly over time, and it moved forward and went back, and moved forward and went back. So it's not a continuous flow of these four steps, or these four metamorphoses. But eventually it made its way through each one of them. So from 1600 to 1900, we have the current, metamorphosis that took place, and the current manifestation that we see as the state, where we have, the government and corporate married and combined together to control the economy, to control banking, to control commerce, to control trade, to control all the different aspects of society that the state now has its tentacles into. And so we are currently in the fourth metamorphosis of this beast, and there's one more to go. And I'm not going to really get into that a lot today, but I wanted to bring up this, that the state has gone through these manifestations, and at each stage, it has required war to build up the resources that it needed to go to its next stage. And the condition that we see right now, as it moves into this final stage, it's going to require constant war. There's going to be constant enemies. And they're going to be everywhere. In the past, you know, the enemy was far away in a foreign land. The enemy was over there, across the mountains or across the sea. But in this final manifestation, the enemy will be everywhere, and the state will be everywhere. And so the war will be everywhere. The war will be constant, and the excuse for war will be constant, and therefore the building up the power of the state will be constant. Now, I want to try to link media to the state and show how right from the beginning, media has been an aspect of government, and in that sense, it's gained its acceptance through the myth of the state. As government grew, and as people believed more and more that government was legitimate, therefore the state was more and more real. Well, as government grew, it used media more and more, and in different and in changing ways. And in doing that, media kept the confidence of people, and that confidence in the media is just like confidence in the government. So in that sense, the media is an aspect of that faith in the state. Now, if you think about how media used to be back in the olden days, before there was a lot of print paper, before, you know, movable type and the printing revolution took place and all that kind of thing, when most things were either printed, block printed in a single thing, or it was hand scribed and hand printed. Well, the media in those days was a town bellman or a town crier, and this goes way back into all kinds of different cultures and different histories. But essentially, the government would have individuals who would, very often they would dress very fancy, and they would go out and they would make the king's proclamations, or they would make, you know, the emperor's proclamations, and they would go, and they would often have. And it changed throughout history, but essentially this is the pattern. They would have maybe a stack of papers, and they would go to the main spots in town, whether that would be a common inn or a gathering place of some kind, some sort of marketplace or whatever. And they would often carry a staff of some kind, and they'd bang it on the ground. Hear ye, or whatever the statement that they would have to make to get people's attention. Sometimes there would be horns blowing or whatever. They would get everyone's attention, and then they would make the royal proclamation. They would read it from the paper, and then they would post the paper, predominantly where people could then read it if there were people there that could read. And this is actually, if you look this up in Wikipedia, the term posting a notice comes from the act of the town crier, who, having read his message, I'm reading this out of Wikipedia, who having read his message to the townspeople would attach it to the doorpost of the local inn. Some newspapers have taken the name The Post for this reason. Okay, so literally you see a newspaper that's called The Post, or, you know, mainstream media of whatever kind. That's where that tradition of naming it that comes from, and several other traditional names come from various other ways like that. But essentially, this was a way for the government to speak to the people, either announcing, you know, we have declared war on France, or there's a new tax on this, or, you know, the king's son has been born, or whatever the news of the day was. It was government propaganda spoken by the mouth of the town crier or the town bellman. So literally, it's the traditional job of the media to be the mouth of government. That is the traditional use for media. That is the traditional role of media, is to be the mouth of government. Late 1600s, early 1700s, a myth began to develop that the media could somehow be separate from government. But this was never more than a myth. If you think about the perfect example of this is like in the 1700s in the colonies before the colonies broke away from England, there were competing newspapers that were sparking up, and they, you know, were pushing the colonists either towards loyalty towards the crown, or they were pushing the colonists toward breaking free and forming their own country or whatever. But either way, these are two competing two competing medias that are still just the mouthpieces of two competing governments, whether they be the rebellious government that's trying to break away and form a new government, or if it's the mouthpiece of the old government saying, no, stay loyal. even in the 1700s in the colonies, the media, as independent as the myth claimed that they were not independent. They were still either the mouthpiece of the rebels or they were the mouthpiece of the loyalists. So, and then up into the 1800s, we get the glimpse or we get the, you see the myth of an independent media. But are they really? Were they ever? You know, in my podcast, I talked about the sheriffs in Ohio and their flaky origin. And I also talked about the War of 1812 and how it was sold to the American public. And that's a good example. In 1812, when we're told the myth is that the media was independent from government, and yet the media just was frothing at the mouth to try to get the American people hyped up to a level of where they would accept war with England. And they did so through some of the same tactics they use today, outright lies, through distortions, through hyping up small pieces of truth, but then hyping them to the point of where there's almost no truth left in them. And so we see that even in the 1800s. We see it not just with the War of 1812. We see it with every single war that the United States government involved itself in all the way up to present day. The media was nothing more than a mouthpiece for the government in each one of those cases. And sure, there's the off voice here or off voice over there somewhere. There's always the Glenn Greenwald somewhere that's objecting to the government. But the main flow of the media is always the mouth of Sauron. It's always the mouth of the deceiver. It's always the mouth of government. When I get back from the break, I'll go into this a little bit more, and I'll talk about the pattern that the media always falls in. Well, not always, but I'd say very often the pattern that the media uses in order to get across its brainwashing and its propaganda. Stick with me. I'll be right back.
BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting BadQuaker.com.
Paper money just doesn't get you what it used to, and we want to be prepared for a possible economic collapse, so visit sonsoflibertymint.com. They specialize in usable, divisible silver. Their signature product, the fine silver quarter, is the world's best bartering tool. Its unique design, shape, size make these 1/4 ounce, 0.999 fine silver bars a must-have addition to silver stackers everywhere. Don't wait to wish you had usable silver. Head over to sonsoflibertymint.com and load up on silver you can use today.
How would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. So I was talking about the media, and, you know, really the hidden reason the media loves war so much. I was talking before the break about how the media hyped each of the American wars before the U.S. government was able to convince people to support them. Well, the hidden reason that the media loves war so much is because ultimately the media is an aspect of the myth of the state. The media thrives because people believe its reports and its stories. So long as people trust the media, it continues to beguile them. You see, but the moment the people realize that the media is nothing more than the mouthpiece of government, then it begins to lose its legitimacy and it loses that beguiling power. It loses, you know, I've talked before about the dragon, about the metaphor of the dragon, and how the dragon, if the dragon lays its eyes on someone and begins to speak to them, the dragon can hypnotize them and change their mind and take them over. And this is very constant in stories about dragons, especially European stories about dragons. Well, in that sense, the media is the mouth of the dragon. It's that beguiling voice of the dragon. It's that thing that engulfs the person's mind and takes them over and bends their will the way that the dragon wants. If you think about, in the United States, mainstream media in like the 1930s, 1940s, and well up into the 1950s, media relied a lot upon radio and newsreel reports between motion pictures and theaters, that kind of thing. And then a new thing started to develop in the 50s with the abundance of television. TV news programs started to become more and more popular in the 1950s, but they really didn't come into their fullness until the Vietnam War in the 1960s. In the 1960s, the pattern of, in those days, mostly you still had the woman who stayed at home and did the womanly work, the housework and so forth. And the man went out and earned the living. And then he would come home at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And then at 6 o'clock, everybody went silent and the 6 o'clock news came on and everybody sat down and watched news of the Vietnam War. And that was life in the late 60s and early 70s. That's how life was in middle America, so to speak, in the wage earner class of America. The man would go out and earn the money all day. The woman would take care of the house and all the issues of children and home and all this kind of thing. The man would get home at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, he would sit down and everybody would watch. Basically, it was the news, but it was basically the Vietnam War. And that's what evening news was in the late 60s. It was nothing more than what's happening with the war. And for this reason, when I believe it was early in 1968, when Walter Cronkite turned on Washington D.C. and announced essentially that the Vietnam War was a lost cause, and LBJ very famously said that we lost Walter Cronkite and we've lost the war. And he understood that. And in that sense, the media is not only a part of the state, it's a very powerful part of the state. It can be as powerful as government, and it can be more powerful than some governments at some times. So in that sense, the media is literally an arm of the state. And when government gets a little bit out of control, the media acts to pull it back in. And many people in media understand that, and they think that's good. They think it's important. They think they are really, really an important aspect of civilization. Well, they're not. They're an aspect of the beast. They're an aspect of that evil monster that seeks to destroy humanity. That's the state, and that's what the media is a part of. When mainstream media kind of lost some of its power in the late 70s and early 80s, because there was no, there wasn't an active fighting war. There we had the Cold War, and the governments were doing everything they could to hype that up as much as possible. And there were all kinds of small skirmishes here and there, and there was different things going on that kept people's attention. But essentially, evening news had lost its luster. It didn't have the Vietnam War every night to draw the workers, away from the kitchen table and sit down and just stare at the TV for an hour and get brainwashed. It didn't have that opportunity because the Vietnam War was over, and there was nothing really going on to capture the imagination like that on a regular basis. And then the first Gulf War came along and gave us modern cable news. If you think about what CNN and other cable news was like prior to the first Gulf War, if you're old enough to remember that, cable news was pretty much useless. You would drop by over there and look at it for a few minutes. It was horribly boring and there was nothing going on, and then you'd move on and try to find something else. Cable news didn't really come into its fullness until that first Gulf War, and then CNN went 24/7 live coverage, and they were giving you the simplified explanations and the constantly shifting storyline and the constant they became a constant outlet for government propaganda. That's what CNN was in the first Gulf War. They were literally the mouthpiece of Papa Bush during that time frame. And then, you know, once the first Gulf War was over, and then you had the conflict between there was the election between Papa Bush and Clinton, and the news media was jumping on every scandal that they could, and they were, you know, trying their best to remain important, trying to continue their role as having some kind of important aspect in the conversation. But they never had the kind of power that they had during the first Gulf War. They never had the ability for people to just stop what they were doing and stare at CNN for hours at a time. They didn't have that power anymore. And then, then we come along to, essentially, you know, when 9/11 happened, and all of a sudden, the news media is back in control. We have a new storyline. We have terrorism. We have fear. We have constant fear. Everyone's in danger everywhere. If they can strike New York like that, if they can strike DC, if they can just do it like that, nobody's safe anywhere. And so this became the new mantra of mainstream media, to scare us at all times and in all places, to constantly keep this level of fear up, because belief in the media has become belief in that fear, that we need them to tell us when we're safe and how we're safe and who we can trust and who we can't trust. And so the media just lives on this hype. And so in that sense, the media feeds on war just like the rest of the state feeds on war. The media needs war. And eventually, when the state makes its final manifestation and becomes what it will become at some point in time, the media will continue this. It will be the voice of government, and it will more and more be that way of which the government controls the minds of people. Now, I want to give you the current formula of how the media controls any particular situation and brings it around to be the storyline that the government wants you to believe. Okay, so first thing you have is a developing an emergency. No one knows exactly what's going on. It's something big. It's really big. We're not sure exactly what's happening. It's breaking news. It's interrupting everything else. We're not sure exactly what's happening. At that moment, it's time to begin the lies. You start throwing in exaggerated things that are just over the top. Don't worry, you can deny them later. It's not a problem. But when that story first starts to break, you really go over the top with the lies, and you really overemphasize how important it is. Now the next stage, we get the wild speculation. What's going on? Oh, I don't know what's going on. We get hints as to what we're supposed to believe. We get more layers of lies, more wild speculations. At any moment, you now, this is the point in the conversation where they start to look for the experts to bring in. They start to bring in the first level of talking heads to tell us what we're supposed to think. The storyline will begin to develop at this point. We're going to start to see what's acceptable in the storyline and what's not acceptable. And we're going to start to see them leaving out critical facts. There's still going to be lies interjected, but right at that point, they're starting to leave out critical facts. Maybe for whatever reason, maybe they think it's not important. Maybe it just doesn't fit the storyline that they're developing. Now, the next stage, we start to see contradictions in reports coming from different authorities. One authority is going to tell you this, and then they're going to bring in a talking head, and he's going to tell you a different, a different story from his vast authority. And so there's more lies, there's more distortions, and we start to see this multiple thing taking place. We're back to wild speculations. There's more hints at what the acceptable storyline's gonna be. But more and more there's lies, and more omissions of the facts. They're leaving out critical aspects that we need to know, but are somehow left out. And if you're following these, and it doesn't matter what the story is, it always follows pretty much the same pattern. If you're following close enough, you'll start to say, hey, wait a minute. How did that happen? That didn't make any sense. Why would a person do that? What would motivate them to do that? That something's being left out of this story. And that's the point where you know that the story's turning south, so to speak. Then there becomes the moment when they need to denounce the errors. They need to denounce the rumors, denounce the errors. Let's get some clarification. And then they'll typically restate some of the early lies. As they're denouncing some of the misinformation, they'll restate some of the early lies. But it appears in every way as though, oh, we're going to clarify this now. More facts have come in. More level heads are starting to prevail. And so now we're going to think about this a little bit more clearly. And at the same time, right in there, they're still slipping in lies and they're still leaving out critical facts that you need to have in order for you to understand the situation. And they leave those critical facts out. And then eventually the fake storyline begins to develop. And anybody that, I left that one point. The experts. The experts return, and the experts go over the story over and over and over until you're sick of hearing it. And when everybody is sick of hearing the story and nobody wants to hear it any further, then the fake storyline has been developed. And anybody who goes against the accepted facts, it's crazy, or they're conspiracy theorists, or they just don't know. They're just idiots. What do they know? They're talking about, we all know the story now. It's all been out, right? It's been talked to the point of where we're sick of it. We don't want to hear any more. So there's the storyline. Now let's drop it and move on. Besides that, there's this new emergency. What's happening over here? Look, it's shiny. We got to look over there now. And that's the pattern that the mainstream media uses to pull the wool over the eyes of people. There last week, this is an actual thing from a New York newspaper. There was horror on the Hill when a crazed Connecticut woman who tried to ram her way into the White House was shot and killed Thursday after leading police on a high-speed chase through the heart of Washington. Of course, that's almost entirely lies. The woman did not attempt to ram her way into the White House. That is a lie. Crazed woman rams barriers, attempts to crash through the White House gates. That's a lie. That's an absolute lie. It appears in every way at this point, from what I've seen, that she may have been highly confused. There may be all kinds of different circumstances, but when she turned on the actual avenue that's going towards the White House, she pulled right up in front of a stop point, of a checkpoint. And a guy in plain clothes, not a uniformed officer, threw a bike rack in front of her car and was yelling at her. And several other plainclothes officers ran at her with guns, yelling at her, banging on her car. And at that point, she panicked, threw her car in reverse, stomped on the gas, hit a car that was behind her, that was actually a police car, and then forward and off she went while the cops are shooting at her. Now, that's not a person trying to ram through the gates. That's simply not what happened. It's a lie to say that that woman was trying to ram through the gates of the White House. And at this point in time, as of Monday morning, there's nothing in actual facts of the story indicating that she was trying to get to the White House. There could be any number of reasons why she was at that intersection at that time and why she turned and was had her car pointed in a direction that she shouldn't have had her car pointed in. And that could have been something as simple as her GPS was malfunctioning, or she was, you know, there's talk of medications and so forth. Maybe she was just simply that confused. You know, when I was young, this is going back to when I was like, 16, 17 years old. And one particular time, I thought for certain that I had found the love of my life. I thought I had found, you know, the girl that was just going to make me happy forever. And she was completely disinterested in me, and it just broke my heart. And so I got in my car. I had a 66 Mustang back in those days. It was a really hot car. I got in my car, and I just took off and started driving. And I drove probably 6 or 8 hours, stopped and refilled several times, drove all around California, middle of the night. I found a place to stop that was sort of back away from where nobody could see, crawled into the back seat, slept for a while, slept in the front seat for a while. It got too cold. You know, I woke up, started the engine, started driving again, and I just drove. Because, you know, not because I was crazy, but I was just trying to straighten things out in my head. And sometimes people do that. Sometimes you just need to go and drive a little bit and get things straightened out in your head. But what if while I was driving around in that state of mind, what if I had made a wrong turn and some thug with a badge, and not even a uniform, but with a badge and a gun, who's already terrified? Because believe it or not, folks, those guards around the White House are in a state of panic constantly, especially when things happen like, you know, the DC shooter that happened not long ago. These guys are constantly told that the world is trying to attack them, and that they're saving the free world, and all this garbage is in their minds, and they believe it to the point of where they are like rabid dogs waiting for the opportunity to jump on somebody and just rip their throat out. And that's how those people are constantly. And so some woman makes a wrong turn, finds herself in a scary situation where there are men running at her, waving guns, yelling, banging on her car. And she panics, and somebody's throwing a bike rack in front of her car to try to block her. And she panics and hits the gas and throws it in reverse and hits something hard, bashes into it, doesn't know what it is, throws it in forward, takes off. People are shooting at her. She's scared to death. She's got her baby with her. She doesn't want her baby to die. She's terrified. She does everything she can in a panic to try to get away. It's not the smart thing to do. It's human reaction. It's the fight or flight mode. She was certainly not in a fight mode, but it's the fight or flight mode that a human falls into when they panic. She was panicking. And in her panic, eventually she rammed into something or other with her car at a different gate, and it stopped her. And now the reports that we have are that the police actually came up, pulled the baby out of the car, and then shot her to death, murdered her. She was unarmed. And she probably wasn't actually, other than the fact that she was driving in a panic, other than that, she probably wasn't a threat to anybody. And they shot her down and murdered her. And then there was a standing ovation in the halls of government, applauding the great heroes that shot and murdered that woman and killed her. But so how does the story portray? When the story comes out, how does it portray it? Well, again, we have a crazed woman rams the barriers, attempts to crash through the White House gate. Oh, that's a lie. Then we immediately we have this proclamations from all the mainstream media. They're all in lockstep. They're all saying she's not a terrorist. She's not a terrorist. No reason to panic. She's not a terrorist. But they're putting that into your mind as they're saying it. Here's an example. Whatever you do right now, you listening to my voice, whatever you do, do not think about elephants. You see? So when they say, she's not a terrorist, what do you think? She might be a terrorist. She might be. And they say, she's armed, she's shooting at police. That was one of the early reports, was that she was shooting at police. There was a gun battle, a running gun battle, some of them said. So she's armed, she's crazed, she's shooting at police. No, turns out she wasn't. That's all a lie. But it's in the early stages of this where they're throwing out all these stories. She's crazy. She's off her meds. She's hearing voices. There's the rumors. There's a friend of a friend heard somebody at the water fountain say that some cop that they used to know anonymously reveals that maybe she was thought Obama was talking to her through her television or something like that. We're not really sure because it's all anonymous sources that come to us through, you know, through four different people. A friend of a friend of somebody was saying this at the cafeteria that maybe somebody might know something, right? And that's what the media is basing their early stories on. Oh, but she's been hospitalized, therefore she must be crazy, right? That's simple. She's been hospitalized, therefore she must be crazy. That explains it all, right? No. We can't buy this kind of stuff. We can't allow ourselves to be taken in that easily. If they're gonna fool us, let's at least make them work for it. Let's not just sit here and accept what they hand us like this. So as of Monday, as I sit and talk about this, we're at the stage of where the experts are going to be brought in, and they're all going to speculate, and they're all going to give their opinions, and they're going to talk about this over and over until no one cares. They're gonna disassemble this, and they're gonna talk about the different aspects of it, and they're gonna go over every part of it until the public is just sick of hearing about it. And then they won't care, and this won't matter anymore because there's gonna be another thing going on. There'll be another shiny object to see. I'll put a couple links in today's show notes. One is for an antiwar.com story on this that is really good. It's a really good story on this, and it really throws shame on some of the shoddy reporting. Another article is by Pete Ayers over at CopBlock. Pete did a really good story on this, and I'll put a link to it in today's show notes. It's really worth getting over there and reading Pete's article. Pete kept a level head, fought this thing through, watched what was happening without allowing the media to take over his mind. And that's what we need to be able to do. We need to be able to maintain our own clarity of thought. Now, unfortunately, you know, I listened to Stefan Molyneux's podcast on this same topic, and I was so disappointed. This was Steph's Friday the 4th podcast, where he talks about a crazy woman endangering a baby, and he talks about suicide by cop, and he compares her to the Aurora shooter and Timothy McVeigh, and it's like, holy crap, Steph. The media just took your mind. You just got hoodwinked. We have to do better than that, all of us. And I'm not perfect. I'm not saying that I'm perfect. I get fooled by these people too. They're professionals. It's what they do. They have perfected the art of propaganda to the point of where, you know, they make the Nazis look like children. I mean, these people in the mainstream media today have absolutely perfected the art of propaganda. They know what they're doing, and they do it well. Let's shift stories here just a little bit. Here's another story that we dealt with in the same, basically the same time frame. Biker mayhem, biker gangs roam the streets attacking families. You know this story coming out of New York? It was the shiny moment right before the other shiny moment. So now most of these, you know, there's video that all the different news people are throwing out there on their websites. Most of the video is around 2 minutes to 2 minutes, 30 seconds. Guess what? That's the attention span of most Americans. That's why most pop music is 2 minutes to 2 minutes, 30 seconds. That's why most news stories are 2 minutes to 2 minutes, 30 seconds. Because that's how long they know they can maintain control of your thoughts. They can hold your thoughts for about 2 minutes and 30 seconds. So they show the 2 minute, 30 second film that they want you to see. They don't show you the whole 8 or 10 minute film. They only show you the 2 minutes and 30 seconds that they want you to see. And that's being played over and over and over. It was last week. Biker mayhem, biker gangs, aha! We all have to panic. Well, let me give my point of view on a biker situation. Now, first off, let me give a little bit of background. I first started riding motorized motorcycles two wheels with motor included. I was bicycle riding since I was very small, but my first motorized two-wheeled device was a mini bike when I was 12 and a half, almost 13. The summer before I was 13 was when I first encountered powered, you know, motorcycles. Wow. And that was it. I had to have it. I had to be on them constantly as much as possible. I put countless hours and miles on dirt, in the middle of the desert, in on beaches, anywhere I could, in forests, on pavement, riding street bikes. I have close to 1 million miles on street bikes. If I hadn't have, if I wouldn't have become disabled when I did, I would have broke over 1 million miles a long time ago. But unfortunately, I haven't been able to ride for almost 10 years now that I haven't been able to ride. But had I been riding in that last 10 years, I would have well broke over 1 million miles, street miles on street bikes. And in all that time of riding, I have never, had a street bike go all the way to the ground. I've never hit the pavement on a street bike. Now, I've had very close calls on a street bike. I've had extremely close calls where observers thought for certain that I was gone and I was able to pull it back out. And it's not because I'm such a, you know, wonderful, magical, talented rider. It's because I have so many miles and so many hours on motorcycles that it, you know, at some point it just becomes a part of you and it becomes like, you know, the way you reach for a cup at a, you know, at a table or whatever, it just becomes natural to your movements. And on dirt, I've had countless miles. Now, on dirt, I've had some pretty bad accidents, pretty bad motorcycle accidents on dirt, but never on a street bike. So I know when I'm talking about street bikes, I know what I'm talking about. When I'm talking about motorcycle culture, I know what I'm talking about. I've ridden lots and lots and lots by myself, and I have ridden in large groups. And so I know what I'm talking about when I talk about motorcycles and motorcycle culture. So I want to kind of give the biker perspective, or at least my biker's perspective on what happened in New York. You know, it looks to me in the video that the guy in the SUV, as the bike started surrounding him, he was clearly in a panic. He didn't know what to do. He had bought all of the propaganda that comes from the mainstream media and comes from Hollywood and all the nonsense. And as all those motorcycles were passing him, he didn't know what to do and he was scared. And he was looking back and forth and he was looking in every direction and he didn't see that a motorcycle in front of him had slowed down. I do not believe for a moment that the motorcycle in front of him wanted to get hit. Anybody who rides a motorcycle very much knows that you will do anything possible to keep a car from actually hitting you. Because when you take motorcycle plus rider plus SUV impact, you have a good chance of losing a leg. Because the bumper of the SUV will strike the motorcycle right in your leg area and pin it against the bike and cut it right off. Lots of bike riders lose a leg when they encounter an SUV or a big car of any kind like that, a big motor vehicle. So it's always, at all times, in the experienced biker's mind, it is always, at all times, in your mind, that you do not want to contact a full-size automobile, because it can mean death if you're lucky. If you're not lucky, it can mean a lot of pain forever until you eventually die an old age, broken down in pieces in a hospital somewhere. So it is never the case. I will never accept the possibility that the biker in that situation intended for the SUV to hit him. In all likelihood, he was slowing down to try to get the SUV to slow down to let all the other bikes go by, because the SUV was actually disrupting. By the SUV speeding up and slowing down in the flow of traffic, the SUV was staying in the middle of all these bikers, and the SUV driver was clearly not comfortable with that, but he didn't know what to do about it. He didn't know if he should accelerate and try to get past them or what he should do. Well, what he should have done is just maintain his lane and maintain one speed and let the bikes go around him. But he was inexperienced and he was afraid, probably because of nonsense from the media and nonsense from Hollywood. And so he didn't know what to do. And so the bikers were trying to get him to slow down so that they could all get around him and go on about their business. They hadn't, why would they have any desire of having a conflict like that and having some of their members, hurt like that? So the biker, as he slowed down in front of the SUV was probably not even looking at him. The SUV driver was probably looking in all the other directions at the same time, because he was so panicked at all the other motorcycles, and he probably didn't realize that that bike had slowed down in front of him. So he bumps him, knocked him down, and he stopped. And people got out from every direction. Now, here's where the story gets distorted by the media. At that point in time, there's no evidence that I can see that anybody was banging on the SUV or that anybody was trying to attack or assault the SUV driver in any way. It was just an accident. It was just a car accident. And this is a time when everybody stops and gets out and sees, okay, well, how are you okay? What do we need to do? Do we need to call insurance? That's when this takes place. And so a couple of the bikers had stopped in front of the SUV, and one of them was walking across to help the other biker who had been knocked down. And at that point, the SUV driver panicked, stomped on his gas, drove over the motorcycles, and drove over one of the motorcycle riders, breaking his ribs, breaking his spine, probably paralyzing him for life if he lives. And then the chase goes down through the streets, and eventually the SUV gets stuck in traffic, and he's still, even at that point, he's acting like he's going to try to accelerate and get away. And so one of the motorcycle riders comes running up with his helmet, smashes the window, and reaches inside. Now, at this point, I'm thinking about, what is the driver of the SUV thinking? Well, he's got this scary situation, scary people, scary men who he's taught all his life are evil and they try to kill people, scary bikers that just go around the city pulling people over and beating them up. And this is the kind of impression that so many people have of bikers. It's entirely false, but that's the kind of nonsense that they've been taught by the media, and that's what they believe. Okay, so he's thinking this in his mind. Oh no, I have my child here. It's scary. And so what's he do? He stomps on the gas and accelerates. It's stupid, yes, but it's fight or flight. And then when he finally gets pinned down in his SUV, he can't get through traffic, and the guy comes up and smashes his driver's window. He can no longer flight, so he begins to try to fight. And it's never smart to try to fight a bunch of bikers. That's just really never a good idea. And so he gets beaten. And then the mainstream media does a funny thing. Whenever they show a picture, or whenever they tell this story now, as I'm flipping around through the different places on the internet and I'm seeing this story, they're showing the picture of the biker who is now paralyzed and in really serious condition. They show his picture, but they say it in a way to indicate that they're showing the SUV driver. You see, they're putting all the sympathy for the SUV driver. The guy who rammed the motorcycle, then drove over top of other motorcycles and drove over top of one of the riders because he panicked. That's the guy who we're supposed to be sympathetic for. But the funny thing is that this man, this SUV driver, what did he do? He was in an unexpected circumstances. He didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to handle it. Suddenly, there were people in front of his vehicle blocking him. Suddenly, there were people behind his vehicle blocking him. They're dangerous people. They're people he knows are dangerous. He's convinced of it in his mind. They're dangerous. They're scary. I don't really understand what they're doing. What are they doing? And so what does he do? He stomps on the gas and he accelerates and he tries to get away. And what do they do? What do they do? Of course, they chase him and they chase him. And then when they get him to a spot of where he can't get away any further and his car is pinned in and he can't get away. And then what happens? Then they attack him. But isn't that what happened with the woman in Washington, D.C.? Isn't that exactly what happened with the woman in Washington, D.C.? Except here's the difference. The bikers did not execute the SUV driver. And no one stood and applauded the bikers. In addition to everything I just said, the reports are coming out now that maybe as many as 5 or more of those motorcyclists were police, off-duty police. There may have only been about 30 motorcycles, and of those 30, five or more were off-duty police. Folks, let me ask a question. How many people are killed by roaming biker gangs? And how many people are killed by uniformed police? Why is it then that we believe? And you see this a lot in the prepper community and in the among survivalist types. There's all this talk about roving biker gangs. Why is it that we believe that the bikers are bad and the police are good? Why do we believe that? Is it the tendency of bikers to stop people randomly and shake them down for money? Is it the tendency of bikers to put up roadblocks and stop people and then take their vehicles? The police do this. Many police forces are supported through the confiscations of drivers' vehicles that they've stopped and take it for one reason or another. Sometimes they make the excuse, oh, well, it's because there were drugs. Sometimes, no, they're just carrying too much cash. Sometimes they're just acting suspiciously. And so we brought in a dog and the dog sniffed and that's enough. And yet, the woman who panicked with her child in the car and panicked, she's demonized. She's crazy. We look for excuses as to why to justify the cops shooting her down like a dog. But the guy in the SUV, confronted by bikers, just as scary to him, he's the victim. We'll show pictures and images of the crippled biker and pretend like it's the SUV driver so that we can get sympathy for the SUV driver. The bikers get arrested. 3-4 of them are arrested. But the guy who rammed the bike and the guy who drove over top of other bikes hasn't been arrested as of the recording of this podcast. What's the difference? Is it just that shiny badge? Is it the propaganda? Is it the way the story is handed to us? I don't have time to go into the whole second half of my notes for today. I was going to talk about a particular terrorist that got captured over the weekend and how that story was used to cover up the fact that a different attempt to capture a different terrorist fell flat and utterly failed. And so they picked up a terrorist that, according to their own admissions, has already been picked up several times. The same guy just keeps getting captured over and over. And yet I didn't do it, but the government captures him again and then proclaims it to everybody. Oh, we got this horrible, horrible terrorist. Yeah, but you guys have captured him like 4 other times. Why is this a big story? And why is it that a sub-headline to that story is that, oh, yeah, but the SEAL teams that were trying to catch this other terrorist in Somalia utterly failed. So instead, we're just going to proclaim the capturing of this one guy who was, by all accounts, just coming home from prayers. And he and his wife are coming home from prayers, and all of a sudden, they get swarmed by U.S. Delta team, drug out of his car in front of his house, beaten, drugged, and then hauled away. And there's this great proclamation. Oh, yes, this terrible terrorist has been captured. Look, there's something shiny over here. Don't worry about what happens on Capitol Hill. Don't worry about the fact that there's some guy that set himself on fire in front of the U.S. Capitol in protest. But you're not going to be told his name, and you're not going to be told the backstory behind that. Because, hey, guess what? There's something shiny over here. We captured a terrorist. We're all safer now. You see, the system works. America is great. Don't look at the burning body. Don't try to find out what his cause was. What drove this man to light himself on fire in front of the Capitol in Washington, D.C.? Don't ask that story. Only feel joy in your heart that one of these evil terrorists has been captured. The story gets bent and twisted and we're told what to believe, and we're told when to look, and we're made tired of the story until we stop looking. Folks, thanks for listening today, and be sure and get over to badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thank you very much.